The Latino vote helped Trump win Florida big. What do the Democrats learn from the loss? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Trump won Florida by more than 300,000 votes, a much larger margin than what he had done in 2016. And one of the reasons for his success, the Latino vote of South Florida.
The Democratic Party for too long have just relied on demographic changes. That's not how this works. You have to earn people's vote.
Democrats also lost two key seats in the House in Miami-Dade. What will the strategy be for Republicans and Democrats to build upon this critical voting bloc? A panel conversation ahead, and we'll take your calls. Also, we'll look at a special anniversary of one of Florida's favorite supermarkets. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, Florida wrapped up its election a week ago today. The state went solidly red for President Trump by 4 percentage points. Political analysts attribute that success in part to Joe Biden's inability to secure enough votes in solidly blue regions like South Florida. Latino voters play a critical part of that electorate. Today, we're taking a deeper look at this diverse set of voters, how their politics have changed, and how the parties are attempting to reach them. Joining us for this panel conversation via Zoom is WLRN Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett. Tim, always a pleasure.
How are you doing, Luis?
Doing good. Also joining us is Lourdes Ubiata. She's a television and radio host and journalist. She's been covering the presidential race closely here for Spanish media outlets. Lourdes, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Definitely. And Fernando Amandi, Democratic strategist and pollster. He's the managing partner of Ben Dixon and Amandi and a lecturer at the University of Miami. Fernand, great to have you back.
It's great to be back, Luis.
And by the way, we want to hear from you, our Latino voters listening in. What drove you to the polls this year? That's the question. What drove you to the polls? Which way you voted? Which way you went? We want to hear from you your thoughts. Was it the messaging? Was it the candidate? Was it the party? Was it something? We want to know. Again, you can call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-WLRN. Email us. Sundial at WLRNnews.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. I have a question, and I'm going to go to all of you on this one, because I want to get a sense of what you saw on the ground, but I wanted to know if there was one interaction, one story, one Latino voter that you spoke with before the election that really illustrates what happened in Florida a week ago. Tim, I'll start with you.
I would go to Election Day. I spoke with a Cuban woman. She's a teacher. She lives in Hialeah. I spoke to her at a Hialeah voting polling site there. And she was probably the only person, and perhaps the only Cuban-American voter there who was voting for Biden. And she told me that she was probably the only person in her family, in her Cuban-American family there in Hialeah, who voted for Biden. And she said it was because she's a teacher. She's very worried about President Trump's performance with the COVID crisis and how that was affecting her as a teacher. And so she was sort of out of step with everyone else in the Cuban American community there in Hialeah, who was voting mostly on this idea that Trump had a much tougher stance against communist Cuba, and that therefore Biden and the Democrats were all socialists, radical socialists, because they didn't agree with that hard line on Cuba. And for me, that really summed up how the Latino vote really played out, particularly in South Florida. You had that very small number of Latinos who were not as focused on the Cuba issue and the socialism issue, and then a very large cohort that the Trump campaign was able to convince that it did matter, that this whole idea that Biden, this false idea that Biden and the Democrats are socialists was true.
And we're gonna talk a little bit about that word socialism quite a bit today. That's an interesting story. Hopefully her family and her friends that, you know, they've all, you know, been able to get past those differences and they're getting along. But that's also the other challenge of this. Lourdes, what about you? What was there a story? Was there a person that for you really told the story of what happened in this election?
Well, you know, with the Venezuelan voters, mostly on the Democratic side, I was shocked to see, you know, quite a few families voting for Trump, just for Trump, not for the rest of the candidates on the strip, just for Trump because of his policies towards Venezuela. So there was kind of an emotional vote for Trump in the Venezuelan community. For his hardline, you know, sanctions, putting the a price on the heads of the people ruling Venezuela. Venezuelans identify very much with this position, with the hardline towards Venezuela. So Venezuelan voters, they voted, some of them, and especially this family, they voted for Trump because of his policies toward Venezuela. More emotional vote. Than any other thing.
So interesting, because Tim's talking about, you know, the Cuban perspective, you have the Venezuelan perspective. This goes to show, as we've been saying over and over, you can't say Latino because there's so many different people and everybody's got a different story. Fernand, what about you? What was there one story, one voter you spoke with that really told the story of what happened?
Well, Lewis, I guess as the pollster, I had the pleasure to speak to thousands of people about it through some of the polls that we did. And that was certainly a sign for us of what was to come. But I think more personally and more viscerally, I would say looking just across the Thanksgiving dinner table a couple of years ago at members of my own family, several of whom had voted for Barack Obama in 2008 and 2012, that all of a sudden sounded like they were guests on Fox News, repeating back some of these absurd talking points that the Democratic Party has become infiltrated by Marxists and communists and socialist subversives. So, you know, that was certainly a warning sign. Obviously, the people in my family are sophisticated people and cosmopolitan, but the fact that they were engaged in this type of thinking suggested to me that problems were to come. And having been very cognizant of the results of the 2018 midterm elections here in Florida, where despite the blue tsunami around the country, that blue wave didn't quite crest in Florida and prevented Andrew Gillum from becoming governor and Bill Nelson from being reelected as senator, I think because of the charges of socialism and communism that were made against them as candidates and to the Democratic Party as a whole. So for me, at least, while the results were sad because I do identify with the Democratic Party, they were not at all shocking or surprising.
Let me start with you on this one then, Fernand, because look, we talk about the polls all the time. And so we had the sense that Biden had this big lead. We saw the election was a lot closer than that. When we look at Florida, especially, Trump took Florida by a lot more this time than he did in 2016. How did that happen? I thought the polls told us differently.
Well, again, I mean, I don't want to get into a he said, she said about the poll, Lewis. All I can say is that there was one poll, the Ben Dixon and Amandi poll, which ran in the Miami Herald in early September, which was the first to say that the Biden campaign was in real trouble in Miami-Dade County. And the reasons why were obvious. He was dramatically, at that point in early September when the poll was released, he was dramatically underperforming what Hillary Clinton had done just 4 years prior. And I know that, you know, for a lot of folks, it was a source of consternation. Sometimes Democrats engage in kind of a blame the messenger mentality. But to the Biden campaign's credit, I think they immediately saw that the results seemed to jive with what they had seen internally.
Yeah.
And immediately they deployed Kamala Harris and Joe Biden. And all of a sudden, the campaign that a lot of folks thought needed to happen went from 0 to 80 overnight. The problem was it was just too little, too late.
Yeah, Tim, because you're following your reporting for many months before the election, I didn't get the sense that you were surprised at all by how things turned out.
Well, unsurprisingly, there's a lot of tension in the Democratic and the Biden campaign effort. There's a lot of tension between those Latino activists who are on the ground here trying to fight against that socialist, that socialista attack that we've been talking about, and the Biden campaign officials, higher up, in the state and in Washington, who were often criticized as Fernand pointed out, you know, responding too little too late to that, to those accusations of being socialistas. It's almost as if the campaign, the people in the upper echelons of the campaign just couldn't figure out why people would be believing a lie like that about a centrist like Joe Biden, for example. Yeah. So the people on the ground here, I think they felt that the campaign needed to get into a more direct gear, a heightened effort of direct contact with voters here, be it on the ground or on the airwaves or in the media, to more directly confront those socialista attacks.
Yeah.
And now, and this is something we reported this morning in our Latin America report. And since then, I've gotten some feedback from the Biden campaign, and they rebut quite a bit of what was in my report. They insist that the campaign did invest what they call a historic amount in Hispanic outreach. And they did spend millions on Spanish language advertising efforts. And they insist that this funding always, as they put it here in a note to me just that I just got a few minutes ago, this funding always emphasized voter contact initiatives like caravans and things of that nature.
We want to get to, we're going to get to what that strategy looked like and what they may do going forward. But I want to go to the phones again, the number 800-743-9576. Again, I want to hear from Latino voters. What drove you to the polls this year? What was your motivation? Let me go to Paulina in Wellington. Paulina, thanks for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, Paulina, tell me what drove you to the polls and what was important to you?
I'm a Democrat. I always been a Democrat, and I think wanting to see Trump out of office, I think he's the antithesis of what the office stands for and what democracy stands for. And I'm not just voting for myself. I'm voting for a lot of friends and family that are illegal and they can't vote for themselves.
But do you think that the messaging from Republicans was stronger than what the Democrats were doing?
Unfortunately, I do believe it. Like, their commercials in Florida started earlier than Democrats' commercials, and I think they did more door-to-door reach. Like, I know people that actually got people going to their houses, knocking on them, and that convinced two people that I know to vote for Trump. And there wasn't a lot of that, understandably, because of COVID. But again, I think more can be done, and you can't treat Latinos like we're all just a homogenous group.
No, we're not one group, that's for sure. Paulina, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Lourdes, I mean, this goes back to also what Tim was saying, is that, the approach from both parties. We've heard about this, too, the door-to-door, because of COVID.
Yes.
A lot of, the Biden campaign was trying to, be safer, not a lot of big rallies, not a lot of big events. Trump's folks, no, they were holding rallies. Yeah. They were doing door-to-door.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, first, I'd like to say that Latinos are not a uniform voting bloc. We are spread across the country and we have wildly different backgrounds. If we are talking about Florida Latino voters, it's not the same as, for example, the border, south border voters. For example, if you live let me give you an example. In Hidalgo, for example, one of those borders cities, they have different problems that we have in Miami. Also over there, the voting increased towards President Trump because of the message of law and order. So what I want to say by this is that it's not only because of Cuban Americans or Venezuelan Americans or Colombians that the Latino vote increase in the whole country. We have numbers increasing in Milwaukee, in Philadelphia, where Puerto Ricans and Mexicans are there in, very pure communities.
Right.
In Florida, if you ask me, I would say that these people from Latinos for Trump, they did a great work here. And I'm gonna tell you why. The outreach is what I mean of the party. First, what you guys were saying about the socialism message, it worked. Why? Because the community here in Florida, a big part of the community comes from country that have suffered direct impact of communism or socialism, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba.
And
then they use influencers. They use influencers like Otaola, who made younger Cuban voters who we suspect that they're going to vote for the Democratic Party to vote for Trump.
That's an interesting
increase.
There's a couple things.
Luis, one more thing. Listen. And their Trojan horse, from my point of view, was the registration they did of thousands of new voters. They were door to door calling for people to register to vote.
And that goes back to
part of the story.
That's what comes back to what the caller said. This the door to door. There was a different effort than what you saw in the Democrats and how they approached COVID. Because you know, one side decided they wanted to. They said they wanted to be safe, so they didn't do what they usually do. But
We spoke
with the New York Times reporter Patty Mazzei about that nuance of different nationalities and how they view politics.
Well, obviously, if you're coming from a different country in South America and you're either an immigrant or a second generation and you're Colombian American, for example, you care a lot about U.S. policy towards Colombia. Same thing about Venezuelans with U.S. policy towards Venezuelans, Cubans about U.S. policy toward Cuba. Puerto Ricans have different interests, of course, because they're U.S. citizens and they have more concerns about what the U.S. policy is towards territories and legislation that affects them and the fact that they're not represented in Congress and the statehood question. So every one of those groups has slightly different motivations. We often see, you know, immigration being an issue that gets talked about to appeal to people from a lot of countries at once, even if that's not the top issue for people, just because it's sort of a way into talking about other issues. It's like a gateway issue. If you are empathetic or compassionate or talk about immigration in a way that is welcoming to people who are immigrants themselves or children of immigrants, then they'll want to listen to you when you talk about jobs, healthcare, and education. Broadly speaking, though, Latinos usually tend to be concerned with the economy, with education, and with healthcare.
And again, that is Patty Mazzei, reporter for the New York Times. Again, we are talking about the future of the Latino vote in South Florida. We have a panel of experts joining us, WLRN Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett, strategist Fernanda Mondi, and Spanish television and radio host Lourdes Ubieta. Again, the number, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. You can email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. And again, the question, really simple. If you're a Latino, what motivated you to go to the polls? What was important to you this time around? Fernand, coming back, all right, so, and Lourdes brought up a few points. Let's look at one in specific. Again, it was the messaging, and one of the things that she said was about how they were kind of recruiting certain voices to help them. You saw a lot of the Trump flags everywhere, the caravans of cars going around the city. That was a popular thing you'd see on the weekends. And again, influencers online, it seemed like that was the strategy and it seemed to work. Did the Biden campaign miss out or did they just lean on regular traditional television and radio ads?
I think it was the latter, Lewis. And that's why, you know, earlier, I think you mentioned someone affiliated with the campaign. You know, they always do this after every losing election. They talk about how much they invested in dollars and how many staffers they hired and this, that, and the other. And I think for those of us that have won in Florida before, we know that that doesn't mean anything. It's all a function of when those dollars are spent. It's much more efficient to spend a fraction of the money that ends up being spent in states like Florida earlier in the cycle, significantly earlier, than to just try and throw hundreds of millions of dollars at the wall and hope something sticks with commercials that may or may not be generating the message. The fundamental problem here that I saw is that the Democratic Party was allowed to be branded here in Florida, especially with Hispanic voters, as the party of socialism and communism. Now, as absurd as that is, and it's an absolutely absurd characterization, the only thing more absurd than that is to fail to confront that and contextualize that, refute it, because then otherwise it doesn't matter who the Democratic candidate is. Someone, like you said, as moderate as Joe Biden will then be seen through that prism and lens. And that's
right.
Where, unfortunately, the Biden campaign just got outfoxed here in Florida.
And you know what? I want to come back to, we're going to talk about the socialism, the word socialism here in a moment when we get back from the break. But Tim, let me wrap up this segment here with you is this. It just seemed like the Trump campaign had energy. I didn't see in the Biden. I saw more signs. I saw more people out and about. I saw and heard more from their side than I did the Biden side. Or am I just imagining things?
No, I think you're right. And part of it has to do with that COVID problem that we discussed earlier. The Biden campaign obviously wanted to be responsible about how direct its outreach was to voters in a health context. But I think also, you know, ironically, you know, the Republicans, I think because they realize that they're starting at a disadvantage with Latinos, for example, you know, you've got a president who's known for his racist rhetoric with Latinos, as well as his fierce anti-immigration policies. I think they realizing that they're sort of, you know, at that disadvantage, they did tend to and do tend to work harder at this, particularly at this idea of micro engaging Latinos, meaning don't treat Latinos as a monolith, as we've been mm-hmm. saying, but go at them more personally and individually. And I think the Republicans did a much better job of that, yeah. despite the fact that the Democrats were coming up with groups, individualized groups like Cubanos con Biden, Venezolanos con Biden. But still, the Republicans did a much better job of making each individual Latino group in Florida and especially South Florida feel as special as the Republicans, for example, have always made the Cuban voters.
Right.
Luis, can I say something?
Lourdes, real quickly. Go ahead.
Yeah, very quick. Yeah, Fernando was saying that it's absurd, the socialist idea the party was selling, but they bought it. Latinos bought it, and that's what matters.
Well, you know what? Let's take a break. We're going to come back. Let's talk about that word and how it was used, and then what, of course, is going to happen moving forward into future elections. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. Again, 800-743-WLRN. Email us sundial at WLRNnews.org. Let us know if you're a Latino. What motivated you to go to the polls this time? We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for joining us today. Well, 32% of Latinos voted for Trump nationwide, a significant number of those Latino voters here in South Florida. Today, we're conducting an autopsy of the 2020 election in Florida, looking specifically at this very complex set of voters. Joining us again in this panel conversation via Zoom is WLRN's Tim Padgett, Lourdes Ubieta, she's a television and radio host and journalist, and Fernando Mondi, Democratic strategist and pollster. And again, we want to hear from you, your thoughts. You can always call us, 800-743-9576. You can email us, sundial at WLRNnews.org. We did hear from some of you via email. Angelo Rosadio wrote in and said, quote, I know communism from Germany, and I know about the dirty, terrible fascist history of Germany. I did not understand why people here buy into how Republicans paint Biden as a communist. All right, we've been saying this word a lot, so let's go ahead and discuss it. Tim, I want to start with you. Socialist. Help me understand how Latinos in general view the word socialist compared to how Americans view the word socialist.
Vastly differently, and that's the problem. In Latin America, socialism has taken on this connotation of, and understandably so, given the regimes that have destroyed countries like Venezuela in South America and across Latin America. It takes on the connotation of destructive, radical, Marxist communism, like Cuba, a la Venezuela, a la Nicaragua right now. That is what the word summons in their context. Whereas in the North American context here, socialism, we tend to think more of, say, Denmark. We tend to think of, you know, the social safety net that combined with capitalism is what makes us such a great society, for example. So, but the Trump campaign was very savvy about realizing that that's a nuance that most Latin American voters, particularly in South Florida, so many of whom have fled regimes where radical socialist Marxist style political philosophy is applied, that's a nuance that they're just not really going to pick up on. And if you call Biden and the Democrat socialists, that Latin American context of the word will take over. It was a brilliant psychological insight, really, on their part, and it worked.
And I have to, I want to correct myself in what I said, too. I want to say how in Latin America socialism is viewed compared to how in the United States, because I said American, so apologize for the using the wrong term. Lourdes, you said it earlier. They bought it. Why?
Yeah. You see, Latin voters have the idea that the Democratic Party is like sort of kidnapped by the leftist of the party, Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, you know, these new stars of the Democratic Party. So what happened is that I believe the Biden campaign made a mistake when they didn't react to the support of people like Gustavo Petro in Colombia, former guerrilla and related to terrorists in Colombia, or Nicolas Maduro, he doesn't need any presentation, or Díaz-Canel in Cuba. So all these elements together give you the perception, and you know in politics, perception is very important, gave you the perception that, oh yes, the party is kidnapped, and these big people that make us in Latin America, that make us run out of our countries in Latin America, are supporting Biden. And Biden is not saying, thank you, I don't want your support. So, you know, they bought it, they believe it. And that's what I was saying before, there is an emotional vote. No, I don't want to have in the United States what I had in Colombia, in Venezuela, in Cuba, Nicaragua.
So
basically, Luis.
Okay, well, Fernand, I mean, moving forward, the Republicans have now stuck that word to the Democratic Party, and it stuck. So now how does the Democratic Party change that, or can you?
Well, that's the problem, see? That's the problem. They are now defined as such. And in politics, the name of the game is defining yourself and your opponent before your opponent define themselves or defines you. And again, you know, everybody wants to focus on the 2020 cycle. Sure, great. It's all true. Fine. But this was a phenomenon that happened in 2018. The road testing, or the pilot program, if you will, of the socialism campaign happened in 2018 here in Florida, when Andrew Gillum was called a socialist, when even Bill Nelson, one of the greatest moderates in the Senate to come out in many years, was also tagged with the label. But what did the Democratic Party do? Nothing. They chose not to counter it. They thought that they were going to litigate the word and redefine the word, when in reality, as Tim pointed out, that's a trigger word. It's a word that traumatizes a lot of people. And rather than confronting it head on, inexplicably and unbelievably, there were actually many people, some of them from this community, that said the Democrats should not even touch that issue of socialism.
Okay, so let's say they give you that responsibility and they say, help us get, how do you do it? How do you attack that word and everything?
Well, sure. Let me answer the question by showing you what we did effectively. Unfortunately, it was too little too late on our end, but we had the privilege of being able to work on the Bloomberg effort that came in these last 4.5 weeks. And what did we do? We were able to find some of the most trusted, well-regarded anti-communists and anti-socialists in the community, people like Carlos Alberto Montaner, who is regarded as the world's greatest anti-communist, Santiago Morales, who was a Bay of Pigs prisoner and a political prisoner for 18 years in Castro's dungeons in the Cuban regime. Both of them cut direct spots, not these like movie trailer studio spots that were just became white noise, but direct-to-camera spots making the case that not only were Democrats not socialists or communists, they were patriots that were trying to prevent the destruction of democracy by this wannabe dictator fascist Donald Trump, who, as we see right now, is trying to stop the results of a legitimate election from being enforced. So that's the message that not only worked, it moved the needle. A 20-point swing just in the 3.5 weeks we were on the air with those spots.
All right,
and so Lewis, Tim, go ahead. I would also add that this has to do with this idea that we were talking about before of going more directly to the individual Latino groups and their particular historical backgrounds. One of the reasons the Latino vote inflated for Trump during this election cycle was that the third largest Latino voting bloc in the state, Colombians, suddenly moved to Trump when historically they have always been mostly Democratic. And at the beginning of the summer, surveys showed they were still with Biden. What happened? In August, Alvaro Uribe, the former president of Colombia, was put under house arrest in Colombia for alleged involvement with right-wing paramilitary death squads. Uribe is actually very popular with Colombians here in Florida because he beat back the Marxist guerrillas in Colombia. The Trump campaign understood that, and they jumped to Uribe's defense, and that helped attract a lot more Colombian voters in Florida over to Trump's side. And that's something I'm afraid the Democrats didn't latch on to quickly enough or stupidly enough.
And Lourdes, I know you wanted to say something, but hold on 1 second, because I want to jump to the phones. We got a lot of calls coming in. The number is 800-743-9576. I want to go to Francis, who's been waiting in Hollywood. Francis, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. And listening to the guests that you have, and they're absolutely right. They used everything, the disinformation, and they did not jump on the lies that were spread concerning Colombia, concerning the house arrest. The Trump machine has been using the socialists since 2018. They marked them. They said they're socialist. Biden, the whole Democratic Party is with Ocasio. They're against Maduro. They jumped on the heartstrings of the people here that are suffering, that left their families in Venezuela. They brought the wife of the most loved person in Venezuela and stood her up and said, look, we got her here. She's here in the chambers when he gave the address there. The address there in Washington, they used this. They used the heartstrings. But what have they done? Did they give them a temporary status? All the people that are here that signed up for asylum? No.
And Francis,
what the Democrats have to do.
You they said something.
Yes.
I want to jump in. I apologize because you said something and I want to jump on it. Misinformation. And I thank you so much for the call. And I know this is an emotional, this is powerful. It's what we believe as a democracy and when we vote. And Lourdes, I want to take what she just said and turn it over to you as a journalist, your take on the misinformation and what you were seeing coming through, whether it was traditional media or social media, but what you were seeing that was really being pushed hard, how much of it was real and how much of it was misinformation?
Well, that's very hard to say. First, I wanted to say something about the Carlos Alberto Montaner and the Bay of Pigs gentleman who supported the Democratic campaign. Young voters from Cuba, these new voters from Cuba, they don't know who's Carlos Alberto Montaner, and they less know what happens in Bay of Pigs. That's why the Republican campaign, they put on air Susana Perez. Do you know who Susana Perez? I didn't have an idea who Susana Perez is. But these young Cubans, they know perfectly well who Susana Perez and Otaola, who happens to be now a celebrity in that, that part of the community.
Just quickly, Lewis, yes. she's repeated the name Otaola, and we should say who he is. Alexander Otaola, who is a very far right sort of YouTube star personality, right, who is very much an asset for the Trump campaign here in South Florida, particularly with Cubans.
As Lourdes said earlier, an influencer. But Lourdes, if we could, again, on the misinformation, tell me what you were seeing.
It's very hard, because from both sides, it's very hard to tell when what is happening is the truth or is just trying to get the perception of the people. When you work on this and you are on air every day and you have these analysts telling you things to influence the listeners, is hard. And for me, I would say that definitely the socialism subject was very, very strong. And again, the perception that the Democratic Party is kidnapped by the hard left members is something that was sold like hot bread on the Latino voters.
Yeah, if I could just jump in a second, I couldn't disagree more profoundly with Lourdes's idea. Now we're playing the both sides game, really. When what we heard, the disinformation efforts you described, they're on Spanish language radio, many of them on stations in this market from hosts that we know, saying that Joe Biden was a pedophile, saying that the Democrats were engaged.
Yes, that's crazy. I agree.
May I finish? Thanks. Saying that the Democrats were calling for abortions in the third trimester. I mean, the type of unhinged conspiracy theory that was passed as real-time news and information, you didn't see any examples of the Democratic Party using those conspiracy theory messages on any of the outlets. They took the responsible track. Unfortunately, it hurt them, because what we have seen now is that the currency and the coin of the realm is that the conspiracy theory unchallenged does impact and sway minds.
And Lourdes, did anybody in Spanish media challenge any of these claims that were coming out?
No, what happens in the, at least in my shows, is that they were attacking President Trump also as a liar, as collusion, you know, the Russian collusion, and they talk about all the relationship that he had with dictators. And, you know, basically that was the subject from the other side, you know.
Okay. Again, the number is 800-743-9576. We want to hear from you. Again, if you're a Latino, what motivated you to go to the polls? And also this other question, too, moving forward, is what is the strategy? If Democrat or Republican, what is the strategy in trying to reach this vote moving forward? We don't have the next elections, 2022. We'll be picking a new governor, or possibly DeSantis, if he does run, will reelect him. And then, of course, 24. And I know that seems far away, and yet our politics, we're going to start campaigning before you know it. 800-743-9576. Tim, you spoke with Eduardo Gamada, who discussed the Democrats' history of failing to engage with the right demographic groups in Florida. Let's take a listen.
It shows how the Democrats are so ineffective in engaging groups crucial for their victory.
So, you know, Tim, this it comes back to the strategy and what has to happen. Looking forward to 2022-24, do the Democrats just see Florida as going red, or do they fight for the state?
Oh, I think they have to fight for this state. I think you've got 29 electoral votes here, and I think it's far too early in the historical trajectory to just surrender Florida the way perhaps they've surrendered Texas, although Texas is starting to come back into Democrats' hopes now. I think it's far too early for that, and I think the way they do start digging themselves back in Florida is with the Latino vote, and they've got to start engaging it more intelligently. And I'd go back to one of the words that Lourdes has used a few times here during this conversation, heartstrings. They've got to understand that a little bit more, that Latinos are not monolithic. They're not someone to be taken for granted by a liberal party or a more liberal party like the Democrats. They have to be addressed more individually, and particularly on a more emotional level. Yeah. Politics is emotions. And if they had simply found their own way into the heartstrings, as Lourdes put it, of groups like the Colombians, like the Venezuelans, like the Puerto Ricans, I think they would have had more success. If they had found a way, I mean, as Fernan was just pointing out, how do you counter that socialism? One of the ways could have been, as Fernand was suggesting, point out the fact that Trump reminds a lot of Latin Americans of caudillos, Latin American strongmen.
Yeah. All right. Let me jump in. I want to go to the phones as we're wrapping up this segment. I want to go to Lewis in Lauderhill because he wants to bring up an issue of religion. Lewis, welcome to the program. Lewis, are you there?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Lewis. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Okay, look, I think you missed one important, so many points. So first, the organization was very bad over here. I tried to help, but it's impossible. They make a one page or a lot of questions that is not right. And a second one, you forget about the churches.
All right, tell me, because you wanted to bring up the role of religion.
Yeah, but, you know, you know, it's pro-life, but the life is not only the child. It's all the people. It's immigrants. It's people is on the border, and the border, they are killing. African American, they are killing. This is part of the pro-life too.
Okay.
And they don't understand. And the thing is, many pastors over here, they tell the people to vote for Trump. And
And that's like, and that's something that we see in a lot of places around the country, not just with Latinos, but is your spiritual leaders and how they are leaning. But you brought up something interesting, and I'm going to go around to the panel on this one. Not just religion, but this comes back to, you know, what Tim and Lourdes had said about, again, making it very personal. And I'm wondering, you know, back to whatever the messaging has to be, if the Democrats want to make a change for the future, is it sounded like, and Lourdes, let me start with you. It sounded like a lot of it was, well, look how terrible Trump is and the things he says on Twitter and how controversial he is. And yet it seemed from like the voters, they wanted to talk about family, the economy. They wanted to talk about business. They want to talk about other things. They didn't care so much about the Twitter.
Yes. And that's why when I started talking to you guys, I was telling you about the voters in the cities in the border, in the South border, how they voted for President Trump. Why? Because if you live in a county or in a city, like one of those border cities, you have different problems than you have here. And you want, for example, if you are the victim of, let's say, the coyotes, or you are in a city that someone just came in illegally, to use the word, I don't want to sound bad, but let's say someone who's not legal in that city, and they go to your boss and said, I do the job for $2. And then you say, okay, hold on, I need here law and order. So that's what also happened.
Right.
Those communities, you know, poor, they say, you know, that message of law and order also worked.
In those communities, you're right. Depending on the community, it was about the messaging. But, you know, Fernand, just coming back because Lewis brought up religion. You know what? Again, it sounded like to me, but you correct me, that so much of what I was hearing from the Democrats is, again, look how terrible Trump is, how controversial he is. And yet it seems to me that the Latino voter was like, I don't care about that. I care about my faith. I care about those things more. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to also litigate the case against Trump. Trump has been the most destructive, anti-constitutional president we've seen in the history of the United States. So it is a referendum on his presidency, and I think you have to remind the voters about that. But were they listening? You also have to make the case for the policies of how the Democratic Party are going to change the lives of Hispanics.
Were they doing that, Fernand? It seemed like they were focusing on trying to attack his character, and the voters weren't really into that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the efforts were made, but again, they just were not done in the way they should have been done. And again, I go back to the early starting, especially in this hyper-politicized environment. These elections and these thoughts around the elections are being formed much earlier than people think, as opposed to later. By the time we got to October, you know, already something like 96% of people had decided, and that's when a lot of money was spent on television messaging. So I just think it comes back to doing it earlier and quicker and getting to the voters before the other side defines the race for them.
We got 2 years for the next election. Tim, what does that become? What is the strategy? We get ready for 22. We could possibly pick a new governor. 24 is a while away, but might as well start early. What would that look like?
Well, I think Fernand makes a good point. The Democrats perhaps were bringing the better policy proposals, but were they presenting them in the campaign in a fashion that struck a chord with Latino voters? You asked us at the outset of this conversation, what was one of our lasting images of the campaign? To me, another big lasting image was President Trump sitting down with Colombian and Venezuelan and Nicaraguan business leaders at a long table in Doral and listening to them and letting them talk and making them feel like they were important and special. I didn't, and as a result, his policies then resonated with them more effectively. I just didn't see that kind of thing with the Biden campaign as this campaign went on, or as Fernand said, if it did happen, it happened too late. Yeah.
Well, you know what? Keep the conversation going on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Again, if you're a Latino, we want to hear from you. Tell us your thoughts of how this election played out, what motivated you to vote, how you voted, and what you think is going to change or what should change as you move forward into 22 and 24. Again, Trump won Florida by a lot. Miami, South Florida stayed blue, that blue turning a little bit more red. People wondering if Florida is going to become red. we got plenty of elections moving forward to find that out. Florida's still a big player, no question about that. I want to thank my guest joining us today. Again, we heard from WLRN Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett, strategist Fernando Mondi, and Spanish television and radio host Lourdes Ubieta. Again, all of you, thank you so much for the time and for the insight.
Thank you, Lourdes.
Thank you.
And again, we'll keep this conversation going because there's always plenty to talk about. Well, still to come, we're going to celebrate a birthday of a very Florida staple. You know what I'm talking about, one of your favorite supermarkets, coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, if you've lived in Florida for even a couple of years, like a few months, you've probably stepped foot into a Publix. It is a Florida staple. Do you have a favorite memory? Maybe perhaps a quirky story of something that you experienced in a Publix? If you did, share it on our Facebook at WLRN Sundial. We'd love to hear those. You know, this year the supermarket chain is celebrating its 90th birthday. And we want to celebrate by going back to this fun story by WLRN's former producer, Alex Gonzalez.
This is WLRN News. I'm Alexander Gonzalez. Floridians love Publix. That's what stood out to Chris Barr when he moved here in 2012.
When you move to South Florida, you realize that there's sort of a cult following of the local grocery chain, that pub subs are heralded as some of the best foodstuffs on the planet.
And there's another staple of Publix.
Walking in and out of the store, I was always just curious because each store has these old scales. Usually people are checking their weight on them. And I'm just curious what the history of it is.
Chris, here's what I found. Hector Martinez was hanging out inside a Publix in January. It's a big store with two floors in downtown Miami. He was buying time while waiting to meet with someone, so he decided to weigh himself right here at Publix.
Got nothing to do, so I stepped on it.
Was the outcome okay, or?
Actually, I got to lose a couple of pounds from what I was told from my doctor, so.
Martinez had stepped off an industrial-looking scale. A large round dial sits over a metal slab in the supermarket's faded green.
As soon as you come in, that's the first thing you see, pretty much, you know, because it's so, you know, iconic.
To learn the mystery of the Publix scales, we have to go back 80-plus years.
Jennifer Bush is the Publix historian. Publix has a historian.
Most people, they didn't have a small scale in their home. That was not common at the time. Small shop owners and businesses, they took advantage of that. They would have a big scale outside, right at the front doors. And it was, interestingly, they called them people weighers, because that's pretty much all they did was weigh people.
In 1940, Publix founder George Jenkins opened the first store in Winter Haven.
It was beautiful. It was marble glass and stucco. As a matter of fact, they called it the Marble Palace. It had some really big innovations, like the first supermarket with air conditioning and automatic electric doors at front that, you know, we take these things for granted today. Can you imagine shopping with no air?
And while other grocery stores kept the scale outside,
like a vending machine, a moneymaker for them, he decided that he was going to put the scale inside his beautiful air-conditioned store, and he was not going to charge anything.
A free people wear, and he placed it in the back. Customers would have to walk through the entire store to use the scale.
His idea was hoping that when they walked in the doors, they would smell these fresh donuts coming off his little donut machine that he had had put in the store and see the beautiful colors and feel that cool air and hear the music that was playing, like one of the first early versions of Muzak.
Publix's headquarters in Lakeland still has the store's first scale. Over time, scales were added to more stores and eventually moved to the front of the store. But they can only be found in Florida. Not Alabama, not Georgia, not Tennessee, just Florida.
When we started going into new markets, it didn't resonate with them as much. So we made the decision, well, we'll just keep this a Florida thing.
There's not a lot of scales to go around anyway. A company called Mettler Toledo stopped making them about 4 years ago.
I think that's going to be a sad part of our history. And I don't know what store it's going to be, what area it will be that will get the last scale.
It's the little things that make the difference. Publix.
It's the bread.
I suppose it shouldn't surprise me, right, that it stems back to a marketing gimmick, as, you know, this notion of putting it at the back of the store and making people walk through the store.
That's Chris Barr again, the guy who asked us to look into the scales.
I'm so happy to learn this history, and especially in Miami, where everything is so new that you feel like you're not accessing history every day, to have a little piece of the past that sort of remains in a space you frequent probably weekly.
Barr says he wouldn't weigh himself in Publix. Too awkward. Now he doesn't have to think about it anymore anyway. He left Florida about a year ago. This story came to us from a listener. You can submit a question or idea for us to look into at WLRN.org. This is WLRN News. I'm Alexander Gonzalez.
And that again, former WLRN producer Alexander Gonzalez. Share your favorite Publix story with us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, we have a special best of program for Veterans Day. We're going to hear from our conversation with General Stanley McChrystal. Also, look at how the coronavirus pandemic has impacted veterans. And finally, a group of special forces now fighting to save coral reefs. All of that tomorrow on the show. I'm Luis Hernandez. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you tomorrow.